You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
We have another terrific panel. In this case, I'm going to go in alphabetical order, not reverse alphabetical order. So Randy Gwynn is partner at Davis Polk, and he's head of their financial institutions work there. Paul Kupiak, resident scholar at AEI, former FDIC, former Federal Reserve. Paul Saltzman, who everyone knows, it's the Clearinghouse Association, the president. Marcus Stanley, there he is, policy director for Americans for Financial Reform, and Steve Strongin, head of Goldman Sachs research, equity research, and former Chicago Fed. So, Randy, you want to?
Okay. Well, I'll just have a picture here. What I'm going to talk about is the distinction between capital and liquidity, which we've talked about some, and more importantly, the role of lenders of last resort in the context of a rapid and orderly resolution of a U.S. global systemically important financial, systemically important banking group, or G-SIB, that has failed or is in danger of failing. I'll actually spend most of my time framing the issue, but once that's been done, it will be pretty easy to see both the need and the appropriate role for lenders of last resort in this context. As almost all of you know, I assume, the FDIC has developed a strategy that it calls the Single Point of Entry Resolution Strategy, or SPOE, for resolving U.S. G-SIBs that fail or are in danger of failing. In less than 2 years, it's been widely endorsed in the U.S. and around the world as the solution, or at least the most promising solution to the too-big-to-fail problem. On the screen is a highly stylized and simplified picture of a U.S. G-SIB. Three subsidiaries. I'll use it as a prop for illustrating the distinction between capital and liquidity and the role of lenders of last resort in an SPOE resolution. The SPOE strategy has four distinct features. First, the parent company, the one there at the top, is put into a receivership or bankruptcy proceeding. Second, the parent's resources are used as a source of strength for its operating subsidiaries by pushing losses at the operating subsidiary level up to the parent level. Third, the operating subsidiaries are kept open and operating and out of their own insolvency proceedings. And fourth, sort of as a product of this strategy, the long-term unsecured debt at the top-tier parent is structurally subordinated to the short-term debt at the operating company level. In other words, long-term unsecured debt acts as a type of buffer or debt shield between the short-term debt and losses, thus reducing the incentive of short-term creditors to run during a financial crisis and reducing the need for liquidity at the same time. The success of the SPOE strategy, however, depends on the top-tier parent of a U.S. G-SIB having sufficient loss-absorbing resources on both the right and left sides of its balance sheet. Both the Fed and the Financial Stability Board recognize this need and are currently working on minimum loss-absorbing resources requirements. The FSB refers to these requirements as internal and external GLAC. Of course, you have to have an acronym. Or what it stands for is gone concern loss-absorbing capacity. The top-tier parent needs enough equity, long-term unsecured debt, and other capital structure liabilities on the right side of its balance sheet to recapitalize the parent. This is what the FSB refers to as external GLAC. An undercapitalized or insolvent parent is recapitalized in an SPOE in this picture. The old one has failed, the yellow one on the left. And the new one on the right is basically, the FDIC or someone in a bankruptcy proceeding forms a new company called a bridge financial company and transfers all of the assets of the failed parent, including its operating subsidiaries, to the bridge and leaves behind in the receivership or bankruptcy all of the parent's equity, long-term unsecured, and other capital structure liabilities. Because the bridge financial company starts out with all the assets of the failed parent but none of its capital structure liabilities, the bridge is not only solvent, but even super well capitalized. But that's only the recapitalization at the parent level, and You know, the first thing someone points out is most of the losses are actually going to be at the operating subsidiary level. And that's where the left side of the balance sheet comes in. There needs to be enough assets on the left side of the balance sheet, some of which the FSB refers to as internal GLAC, although that's kind of a funny term. In any event, that is used to recapitalize any of the operating subsidiaries that may need recapitalizing in an SPOE situation. Now, it's extremely important at this point to sort of highlight the role for a lender of last resort in this context, to make a distinction and emphasize a distinction between capital and liquidity. Assets need to have real and measurable value to provide capital. They do not need to be liquid to do so. Both liquid and illiquid assets count as capital. So when we talk about the holding company or the operating subsidiaries being recapitalized, that doesn't mean that they are fully liquefied. Now, assuming that a U.S. G-SIB has sufficient internal and external GLAC, an SPOE strategy can quickly separate a U.S. G-SIB into a good bank and a bad bank. The good bank is the supercapitalized bridge financial company and its newly acquired operating subsidiaries that have been recapitalized by downstreaming the assets from the bridge to the operating subsidiaries that are in need. The bad bank is the failed parent and its liabilities left behind in the receivership or bankruptcy, which is illustrated here by the yellow box. So that's the framework of SPOE. Now we get to the role of lenders of last resort in an SPOE resolution. The bridge and its newly acquired operating subsidiaries are now recapitalized. That's why I refer to them as the good bank. But SPOE will not be successful unless the good bank has access to sufficient liquidity. If the market has sufficient confidence in the capital value of the good bank, it should be able to transform its illiquid assets into cash or other liquid assets through market facilities, including a DIP financing facility. But that's true only if the market is operating normally. The problem in the situations we're usually talking about, the market is dysfunctional, and even good banks may not be able to get enough liquidity from the private sector. That's exactly why we have the discount window for good insured banks and for the uninsured U.S. branches of foreign banks, good foreign banks, during a financial crisis. But now let's compare it here. The bridge financial companies and their non-IDI, non-insured depository institution subsidiaries are not insured banks. They're not even uninsured U.S. branches of foreign banks. They're not otherwise eligible for the discount window, even if they're supercapitalized, uninsured good banks, very similar to what does have access. So who will be the lender of last resort for them? If the answer is no one, then we may be faced with another Hobson's choice between taxpayer-funded bailouts and a fire sale liquidation of an indisputably well-capitalized good bank. We know from decades of experience how that dilemma will be resolved. Bailouts will be inevitable. No responsible decision maker, no matter how committed he or she is to the free market or avoiding moral hazard, will risk forcing the public to eat out of tin cans or live in shanty towns because of not providing liquidity. The orderly liquidation fund, in a Title II proceeding, the orderly liquidation fund will act as the lender of last resort. The FDIC has said, and this is not necessarily in the statute, but this is their policy, that they will only use this lender of last resort authority in accordance with the rules established by Badgett. That is, they'll only lend to entities, all of which by definition have been recapitalized, are solvent and well capitalized. They'll only provide liquidity on a fully secured basis and only at above market interest rates. Now, this was developed for Title II of Dodd-Frank, but it could actually be used in the bankruptcy code, either using a current provision, 363 of the bankruptcy code, or with a new Chapter 14 that some people have proposed. In that context, the Fed could function as the lender of last resort in an SPOE under the bankruptcy code, except for one thing. The conditions imposed on Section 13.3 by Dodd-Frank creates enormous uncertainty and possibly some real hurdles about whether it will be available to a good bank in an SPOE strategy under the bankruptcy code. So in conclusion, if we think it would be useful for the bankruptcy code to be a viable alternative to Title II and reduce the need for Title II, which I happen to be a person of that belief, then we actually need to resolve this issue, and we need to have a clear lender of last resort authority that can provide liquidity to a good bank, an indisputably good bank, in an SPOE strategy under the bankruptcy code. Thanks a lot.
Hi, I want to first thank the organizers for inviting me. It's quite an honor to be here among all these smart people, and I'll try to keep up with the rest of you. So in this session, I sort of had to decide what to talk about, and that was a tough thing. Liquidity is a big area, but what I decided to do first sort of have this beef. I think that the hardwired liquidity rules are really inexpensive thing for the economy. I mean, basically, the LCR says that every bank every day must be prepared to meet a 30-day run. Okay, so every bank has to self-insure for a 30-day run. NSFR says you have to be prepared to have a very tough year where your assets roll off and your liabilities, and they're matched for a year. So everybody has to self-insure for a really bad time, all the large banks. You have a whole lot of liquidity locked up to meet the rules. I don't see how this can't but restrict bank credit and push intermediation out of the system, and many of the people up here earlier today said that. So what I think is, in this post-crisis world that Don told us to talk about, in the new world when we move forward, I think we need a market for systemic liquidity. And I will say that this is my idea of a market of systemic liquidity, but after talking to Daryl Duffy at lunch, he thinks some other folks have similar ideas, and I'll track those down and give them credit. But right now, I can only tell you what I've been thinking the last few days. So I think the Federal Reserve should, in the future, figure out how to sell systemic liquidity options. If the system needs liquidity to avoid a crisis, the Fed's going to have to provide it. They're the only one who can liquefy things. And so why not get paid to provide liquidity insurance ahead of time? And it goes back to the taxpayers. And so I'm thinking of something that I would call a systemic liquidity option. And it would work in my roughed out idea, something like this. And do I have all the details down? Absolutely not. But here's sort of the big picture. So once a month, periodically, the Fed would auction one-month options that allow a holder to repo collateral overnight with the Fed. The Fed would set the haircut and the repo rate on specific collateral, specific types of collateral. They could offer a series of haircuts. They could have a bigger haircut than is in the market, but relatively small, and maybe a medium-sized haircut over the market and a larger one. The contract should cover the collateral that's typically used in the market. And they would take dealer bids from dealer banks. And in my world, they would take bids from people in the firms in the shadow banking industry that are qualified. But under 13.3 rules, maybe they can't do that. So we might have to work on that a little bit. But they take bids from the dealer banks and other qualified firms, and who would bid an option premium rate and a quantity of these repo options they wanted. The Fed would decide how much insurance they want to issue, just like they did in some of the past auctions during the crisis. And the repo holder, the person that buys the repo, the institution that buys the repo, would have the right to post the collateral with the Fed overnight on the terms of the repo contract for as many nights as it wanted in the option active month. So it could be one night, it could be many nights. And the dealer banks, whoever buys these repos, could resell them. So there'd be a secondary market in these liquidity options, partially used options, so there'd be a real market, I guess, for used options. Anyway, primary and second, there'd be this trading, and the secondary market prices would allow the Fed to monitor liquidity constraints in the repo market in real time. I mean, one of the big problems in the last crisis was the Fed didn't really know what was going on into the repo market until it was a real problem. And with these kind of things, you would be seeing daily dealer quotes, secondary quotes on what these liquidity options were trading for, and they could reopen if they wanted to or if they thought. And once these things were in place and issued every month, it would be a form of liquidity insurance. I would envision the Fed would not dominate the market. It would price an option so that it was insurance under a haircut bigger than the market. But if the market got into trouble and it needed to use this to provide liquidity, it could easily adjust the haircut so that it would be at the market. It could make the market by just adjusting the terms of the option. Just an idea. So anyway, to make people want to buy these options, you'd have to adjust the liquidity regulations. You'd have to adjust the LCR and the NSFR so that you get credit for these liquidity options. And right now in the LCR, for example, there's a whole bunch of collateral that gets a 50% haircut or a 15% haircut, and it's limited to 40% of the high quality assets. If you owned one of these options, these overnight options, well, you'd be able to use that collateral, at the haircutted value in the option. You would have bought the right to use it, the central bank credit. You'd have paid for it ahead of time. The Fed would get a fee for it. So why does this help the economy? Well, not all of the large institutions have to fully self-insure each and every day. So the insurance somehow gets pooled. We need less of these assets tied up for insurance. And if we created the appropriate regulatory incentives for non-financial bank institutions, they would buy these things too and use these things too. So it's really a market-based substitute for something like Jeremy Stein's uniform regulatory haircut rule, where he wants to, expand. He says we can't just do it, in the banks. We're going to have to be able to regulate haircuts throughout the financial system. Why don't we introduce a market that somehow gives us information back in real time and we get paid for this insurance, since we're going to have to insure it anyway? And Gary Gordon's got some things on limited purpose banks. So I'm going to stop there since I'm out of time. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. I want to thank Doug and Martin for a great conference. The level of this discourse has been fantastic, and thank you all for paying attention. There are benefits to sort of going later in the program. You get to comment on the panelists that are preceding you, which I'm going to spend my 5 minutes on doing. The negative is that many of the people that have preceded you have already stolen your talking points. So I'm just going to be very brief and perhaps save the remainder of my time for the panel discussion. I do want to comment on Charlie Calamaris's point. I do think it's worth belaboring a little bit, this notion that liquidity risk is a manifestation of insolvency risk. I do think is a paradigm that really needs to be questioned. The consequence of Charlie's observation is that capital is the solution to all problems. And I think, as we've heard earlier, that's a regulatory panacea too often, and we need to sort of rethink that. So I was pleased to hear that Mary was focusing on market liquidity. Too often we're focused on the resiliency of intermediaries and not enough focused on the resiliency of markets. I do think it's a little late to be questioning the fundamental premise underlying bank liquidity regulation. The fact of the matter is the LCR and the net stable funding ratio is here to stay, whether we like it or not, and I think we need to learn to live with it. I would say that one often forgotten paradigm is that regulators forget that the marketplace often accelerates the implementation of rules and regulations. If you listen to bank investor calls, bank disclosures, they're already talking about compliance with LCR and its stable funding ratio parameters. So, again, although I would welcome this sort of fundamental review of the costs and benefits, I do think we need to understand and appreciate that we are going to live in a world where we do have very prescriptive bank regulation of liquidity. A couple of key issues in the bank liquidity space that haven't been mentioned that I would just bring to your attention. Number one, we haven't really talked about the disclosure impacts of bank liquidity regulation and whether or not that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Banks need to disclose where they are in terms of LCR coverage. If they drop below LCR coverage, are there disclosure obligations that create the very self-fulfilling prophecy of bank runs that we're trying to avoid? The other problem that the industry is very concerned about is when you look at the bank liquidity regulation, there's no credit for mitigation. It kind of assumes a cliff effect. It kind of assumes that all of a sudden J.P. Morgan's $500 billion of level one assets just go poof, and there won't be management actions to reduce the balance sheet or de-risk. I think that potentially leads to the overinsurance that we were talking about before. And then lastly, again, something that might be a little more self-evident to those in the industry is, just like CCAR has become the binding constraint, superseding really the Basel and Fed capital rules, I think it's pretty self-evident that at least on the industry side, CLAR and liquidity stress testing will rapidly become the binding constraint. So it's nice to talk about all the prescriptive rules and so forth, but I think it's highly likely that the Fed will impose CLAR-type framework on liquidity. The next observation, kind of interesting. We were talking about how difficult it is to distinguish between classic theories of lender of resort liquidity lending to solvent institutions. I do think it's important to appreciate that one of the benefits of CCAR, of CLAR, of capital regulation, of liquidity regulation, at least with respect to the banking industry, is that that probably enhances the ability of the central bank to make those difficult determinations. They now have a plethora of data about what bank balance sheets will look like under various stress circumstances. So that difficult determination as to whether you're lending for credit-impaired assets or liquidity-impaired assets might be a little easier. So I would offer that for discussion a little bit later. The last thing that I'll talk about, which I suspect will mix it up a little bit on the panel, is it's terribly disconcerting how the political dynamic has redefined lender of last resort liquidity as somehow being a bailout. Central bank liquidity and the Bagehot functions that have been around for 200 years somehow now is getting this recharacterization as a bailout, and it's very important that we not conflate those two concepts, very, very different. And then lastly, I'll just say it's also interesting how very little discussion has been had about the impact of all this liquidity regulation on monetary policy. And maybe, Don, we could talk a little bit about that on the panel. You know, is the discount window an anachronism at this point? Central banks do often impact liquidity for money supply purposes, and it's not just about sort of providing liquidity to the system, so it would be interesting to mix that up. So with that, I'll just stop and turn it over to my fellow panelists. Thank you.
Hi, so I'm Marcus Stanley. I'm the Policy Director of Americans for Financial Reform. We're a coalition of public interest groups working for stronger reform of the financial system. And it's often my role at these kind of events to say the things that none of the other panelists say, to kind of hold down the left end of things. And so I'm going to start out by doing exactly that and say that I really don't believe that Dodd-Frank has restricted lender of last resort liquidity assistance, and that it may even have increased it. It's changed it. That's certainly true, but it may even have increased it. I take it that John Dugan took on this issue before I came, but you can see three of his new limitations there on the left side. FDIC debt guarantees requiring congressional approval. They haven't disappeared, but they require fast-track approval. The Exchange Stabilization Fund cannot be used to backstop money market funds, though it can be used to backstop other things, interestingly. And, of course, the restriction on emergency lending to individual institutions. But against these three, we have three new avenues for liquidity assistance that I think are pretty important avenues. One is the discount window access for financial market utilities, which could become quite important, especially as more and more things get moved to central counterparties. The Treasury line of credit, the orderly liquidation fund for failing financial institutions. And third, I think that there hasn't been enough attention paid to the significance of the way the Dodd-Frank Act, even though it takes away 13(3) lending to individual institutions, really gives statutory ratification to so-called broad-based programs for multiple institutions. what the Fed did in 2007 through 2009 was really historically unprecedented. It really pushed the boundaries of 13-3, and most of the money that went out in that period wasn't to individual institutions. It was through a whole alphabet soup of different facilities that supported broad markets, but sometimes very narrow. Those facilities were often dominated in their use by a very narrow set of institutions, three, four, five different institutions. And that is, now there's explicit statutory permission for that. And the impression that this is important, I think, is strengthened when you look at the actual Federal Reserve rules, the policies and procedures for 13-3 lending, which came out a couple months ago, and there's really almost no specific restrictions there. There's no restriction on the duration of program use, how long you could be dependent on these programs. There's no realistic solvency check for users of the program. There's no definition of broad-based beyond not being a single company, and there's no specification of Badgett-type penalty rates for use of the program. Now, it is secured lending. It is lending against collateral, but there's a circularity there in that the value of the collateral may depend on the availability of 13-3 emergency lending. If you're supporting a market, then, you know, that collateral is fine when the market is supported, but it starts to become difficult to withdraw that collateral. Now, in terms of single point of entry, we've already had some discussion. The commitment in single point of entry seems to be to keep the subsidiaries open. That's going to be a very demanding of liquidity to do that. I mean, one number, I should have put it up here, the largest private sector debtor in possession loan in history is $8 billion. For the largest global banks, they have about $300 to $400 billion in short-term liquidity needs. So you look at the gap between $8 billion and $300 to $400 billion, that's a big liquidity hole. Now, the Treasury line of credit in the orderly liquidation fund is secured by the value of the company, 90% of the value of the company. But once again, we have something of this circularity problem. If the value of the company is dependent on the availability of liquidity, then it becomes difficult to extract yourself out of that liquidity without losses. And there are provisions to repay the losses, any losses that are incurred to the orderly liquidation fund, but there's an effectively unlimited period to do that. It's 5 years and infinitely extendable in terms of the repayment period. So there's potentially serious exposure there. And I just wanted to end with, I think an apropos quote from Ben Bernanke from the Open Market Committee transcripts that were recently released, in which he says that the ideal way to deal with moral hazard is to have a well-developed structure in place before the crisis that gives clarity on the terms and conditions for the use of lender of last resort support. And I don't really think we're there yet. I'm not going to tar lender of last resort support as saying it's always a bailout. There's a long tradition. But I think the structure and limits on it are critical, and I don't really see that structure and limits there in the combination of SPOE and the 13-3 Emergency Lending Authority yet.
Pleasure to be here. I assumed when I was talking after Marcus that the only thing I would be doing was responding to him. I agree with what Ben just said. I actually want to talk a little bit about the question David asked and Mary raised today, which is what's on the other side of this? I think one of the reasons the liquidity rules themselves have not generated a tremendous amount of anxiety on the part of the banks goes back to what Adam said. I think it actually reflects the way most of the major banks looked at their liquidity to begin with. I think the point where it potentially has some interesting policy implications is what happens under stress. There is a very big difference between internal policies and guidance and formal rules. Because if it's internal policies and supervision, and you get into an emergency situation, and the right answer is to draw against those numbers, you can. If there's a formal bright line that says you're supposed to have at least X, then all of a sudden that can become a very hard boundary and become a binding constraint. So the formalization of what had been good industry practice may actually become a real problem. And I think Mary pointed to the place to look. which is the market liquidity. You know, one of the interesting things when you sit through a conference like this, especially a good one, and I think this has been that, is understanding the shared perspective of the speakers. And then asking the question, is that really the perspective you need for the whole question? And one of the things about today was the definition of liquidity in almost every sentence was funding for a bank. Right? It was not liquidity for an asset or liquidity for a client of a bank. Right? And so as you hold liquidity in the bank, the real question you want to ask is, what does that do on the other side of that line? What has it done to market liquidity? What has it done to available client liquidity? The answer is, as Adam put it quite succinctly, is it will change the products and prices. Right? And as Murray put it, and that will cause the asset managers to change their behavior. Well, that actually has happened. Right? And I think it's in thinking about the changes we have seen you begin to get the answers to the questions. Martin asked the question, there's lower liquidity. When you look at the corporate bond market, what you see is roughly the following. The top tier of assets trades today about the way it traded 5 years ago. The mid-tier of assets trades about 20% less liquidity. The bottom third trades with about 40% less liquidity. The response of the marketplace to that has been to shift their portfolio to valuing liquidity. You see it in the prices of corporate bonds. You see it in the prices of certain types of stocks. You see it actually in the structure of companies. You can fund cheaper if you're large. That's not banks, that's regular corporations. Right? You know, you place $49 billion of Verizon debt in a half an hour, a high-yield bond will take an extra 100 basis points of commissions and will take 2 weeks to fill. So you've changed the funding costs across corporate America. You've changed the optimal corporate structure across the entire economy. And that has real implications, not super well defined. Mary made the argument, in essence, that it would hurt jobs because those other companies are the job creators. I actually believe large corporations create jobs, so I won't take that as exactly the given. But I do think it does raise questions about where we're going. It also raises a different specter. You know, the other thing I was thinking about today's speakers is how all of us clearly are all tarred, feathered, and focused on 2008. My first crisis was 87. Okay, and I think if you think about the spectrum of liquidity, what we have done is substantially reduce the probability of an 08 style where the banks run out of funding and substantially increase the probability of an 87 style problem where the markets run out of liquidity. Right? Because under a stressed environment, the banks are not going to be able to provide that liquidity out. Right? And so the markets are. And you're already seeing this in the way markets act. Every risk adjustment today, and you saw this with respect to what just happened in emerging markets, you saw it as the Fed did tapering. The ability of the asset managers to move their portfolio around is substantially reduced. What that means in practice is asset prices move more. That, in general, under real pressure, creates price gaps, and prices begin to stop trading. Now, that works differently in different markets. And that's something that isn't well understood in these discussions. High-quality markets, short-term funding markets, tend to stop. Right? They're not well-structured to deal with greater risk. You know, I run research at Goldman Sachs, this was mentioned. Well, at any given time, myself and my counterparts across the street are managing a couple thousand people who analyze equity risk. We're managing a couple hundred who analyze bond risk. We're probably collectively managing less than one person who's analyzing short-term debt risk. Okay, and so when the short-term debt markets have a problem, they stop. Okay, the large markets gap in price down and continue trading, exactly what you saw in the crisis. And so we're creating a situation where we're probably going to replace funding problems at banks with market volatility. Okay, and the social costs of that are going to be complicated to assess, but very real. The other thing we're going to do as we stop banks from taking on that risk is we're going to keep it in the real economy. Right? And as we keep it in the real economy, it'll be the factories and inventory financing and all of those things that suffer through the next crisis rather than the short-term banks, short-term debt market for banks. Right? So we're transferring the risk. We're not making it going away. The risk we made go away is economic activity that didn't happen. Hopefully there's not too much of that, right? Although the evidence would suggest there's at least some. So I think as we look at these questions going forward, right, we really do have to think about that dynamic of bank funding risk versus market risk and begin to ask what that trade-off is we want to take. And lastly, and this goes back to something that Daryl was bringing up, We also, I think, want to look at what the causes of the problems in these markets are, which, again, differs. In the short-term market, the core issue is the ability to value collateral. What we are doing in this process is essentially causing people to hold liquidity buffers against the uncertainty in how you will value that liquidity in a stressed environment. Okay. Perhaps what we really ought to be looking at is how do we adjust market structure to make it easier to get prices on that short-term collateral, right? Because government guarantees have one aspect of this. Charlie talked about that. Lender of last resort is essentially the government setting a floor below which those assets will not be valued. One could think of clearinghouse-type arrangements or other things that give us better prices. But really what we probably ought to be focusing on if we want the system to work well is how do we improve those prices as opposed to how do we buffer up the system to stop. And with that, I will stop.
Terrific and thoughtful set of panelist comments. Let's see if we can lead off the discussion. I actually...
Do you have your mic? It's not
picking up?
It's not on.
Not on. Well, that's a good... All right. I'll wait a second.
Existence is not sufficient.
Just because I see it doesn't mean it exists. No?
Yes.
There you go.
Okay, all right. So thanks for a terrific set of comments again. I kind of like to start with where Steve left off or explore that topic because Mary brought it up too, the intersection between liquidity, funding liquidity requirements and market liquidity issues. So, and I guess to start with Steve, but... go down the line, anyone else with comments, when people talk about the erosion of market liquidity over the last year or so, they often reference the Volcker Rule, leverage ratios, just risk aversion in the wake of the crisis. How important are these liquidity requirements to that development? And are there things the authorities could do with the liquidity requirements to ameliorate these adverse effects?
I think one of the things that's made this very hard is the sheer number of rules. One of my colleagues has commented a couple times that if it's a 4 or 3-letter combination of letters, it's a banking rule. But there's a real probabilistic sort of very complicated math issue that we now face on a daily basis, which is we find ourselves estimating product line by product line what is the probability of various rules binding. Okay, so that in the matchbook zone, which Mark and I talked about earlier, it's the liquidity rules and the leverage ratios that tend to be the binding rules. They're low on risk, but they're high on balance sheet. So those activities tend to get bound there. The issues with high-yield bonds would almost certainly be the capital rules and CCAR rules and the Volcker rules, which would tend to bind you there. CCAR and Volcker together penalize stuff where you're going to have to warehouse it, right? Because under Volcker, if you're having to warehouse it, the regulator could decide it's a prop trade, okay? And under CCAR, if you have to hold it for a long time, there's a chance it gets caught by the shock. And so your willingness to warehouse for a client has been substantially reduced by those two rules in anything that is lower liquidity in the corporate debt market, the equity market, or the commodities market. Those two rules are not that important outside of those markets. They're the other rules fine.
Donna,
Paul.
I think the unintended consequences of these liquidity rules in a crisis circumstance is something that needs certainly more study. I mean, if everyone is rushing to acquire high-quality level assets, what will that do to the liquidity, the market liquidity of non-high-quality liquid assets?
you're essentially replacing governmental determinations of what's liquid or you're replacing private sector determinations of what's liquid with public sector determinations of what's liquid. If a bank says, hey, look, I see some positive return on a level two asset, I really would love to buy that. I'm otherwise solvent. Oh, I have the LCR or I have my CLAR or whatnot. So I think more study needs to be in that regard.
The Fed has specifically said that it's going to draw down the LCR limits in periods of market stress. And, I mean, the purpose of liquidity reserves is precisely that you would want to draw on them in stress periods. And, you know, the Fed specifically said in the rule it was going to permit that. I do believe that they're going to permit that. And in a way, what you can look at liquidity reserving is doing is moving lender of it's taking a stock of resources for something like not lender of last resort exactly, but that liquidity backstop and moving it out of the government and into the private sector, and you pay a higher price in good times when you're holding that reserve in the private sector, but you do get to use it in bad times. So you can think of liquidity reserving, I think, both as a counter-cyclical and also related to monetary policy. So,
do you see this adverse connection between the liquidity requirements, the funding liquidity requirements, and the market and the deterioration of market liquidity that others have noted?
Well, I mean, this is not something. Unfortunately, I don't have a staff of thousands of analysts to look at these issues for me. So I'm not going to get into modeling kinds of issues here. But I guess I would say something about this issue of market liquidity, which is that I think in the wholesale funding markets. And this goes back to what Doug was saying about maturity transformation. The people figured out how in the wholesale funding markets to do very extreme maturity transformation in a sort of non-institutional, uninsured environment through the medium of collateralized lending. And that was great. And the liquidity promises that were made in terms of having access to your money in a short term were great until the music stopped, and the challenge we're faced with now is, wow, you know, we understood bank runs in the institutional context. How do we deal with bank runs in this sort of wholesale funding context? And I think what Stephen said about having only one analyst on the short-term funding side was very telling, too, because there is, how are we going to get that market discipline in there? I think that having those reserves are kind of a way of trying to mutualize that risk a little bit, or not mutualize necessarily, but create a private sector backstop for that risk.
I think liquidity and liquidity regulation, the LCR and the banks are the first round. I think the stricter these are, the more it moves into the shadow banks, and I think the FSB and other people are on record basically saying we're going to have to regulate liquidity in the shadow banking market, which is repo and other things and the repo run. And the thing about that is things like collateralized overnight lending, repo, they serve a purpose in an economy. Now, there's this notion since the last crisis there must have been too much of it, there was excess liquidity. But as a profession, there's a whole lot of literature that says, you know, people take long-term assets and they use them to borrow short-term as inside money, and it serves a very useful purpose. Growth is higher in all kinds of macro models when you have inside money. So there's a right amount of inside money. Now, we as a profession don't know if we have too much inside money or, you know, not enough inside money. And if the liquidity rules pushing things to the shadow sector, and then if the next step is treating shadow banks like banks and putting the same banking regulations on all the shadow banks, you know, we've got this bank constrained mentality. And I don't think as a profession we know the effects of that. I think the private markets do things for a reason. Sometimes they go to excess, but let's hope most of the time it's actually for a productive purpose. And sorting out when enough is enough and too much is a hard question.
Yeah, maybe this goes to the issue of price versus quantity restraints. So there were certainly repos done against illiquid collateral,
Bear Stearns is a good example. And that stuff, those collateralized loans collapsed, and they lost access to liquidity, and it was clear ex post that those weren't priced appropriately. They were priced to be more liquid than they turned out to be.
So there are
ways of regulating here, but one is to build the externalities into the price without necessarily setting ceilings.
But I think you have to be careful. You know, Marcus made a comment in there that I think it's important to understand why you can't do that. He said it's important to get appropriate market discipline into those markets. When you talk about a short-term instrument, there is no information to analyze. You know, 30 or 40 years ago, you had a correspondent banking arrangement where a bank actually knew what the weekly balance sheet of a company was. Right? You only have quarterly information on these firms. Right? So your ability to analyze how risk changes from week to week simply doesn't exist. So you're really assessing their long-term debt risk and applying it short-term. Because that's all you can do. Now, there are certain instruments, and ABS and other things one can think of as macro instruments. Right? But I think in the broader sense, particularly of the corporate-specific instruments, the short-term debt market is a logistics exercise of short-term funding and needs to be safe. And I think one of the most important aspects of SBOE, right, is it segments the risk. It makes the risk holder the long-term debt holder and says we're going to put lots of protection in front of the short-term debt holder who isn't prepared to take that risk. And so you get the right market answer by structurally protecting the short-term debt holder, not by getting the market incentives to analyze it incorrectly. You actually reduce the risk.
Right.
Right, which is a different kind of solution.
Right. And that was a point I think Randy made in his presentation about using the long-term debt to protect the short-term debt, which gives me a way of transitioning, I think.
Let me actually comment on that last.
Yes,
right, because I'm probably the only non-economist here on the stand here, so I hesitate. But it does seem to me that there was discussion about cost-benefit analysis in some of the prior panel. And I know that Mark VanderWeide and others raised the skepticism about the ability to sort of measure the benefits of some of these things. But I think one can actually measure the cost, and I'm not sure that one shouldn't at least have an economic impact study of the cost. So, for instance, if you say, if in fact the banking system is forced to overinsure both in capital and liquidity for various policy goals, it must be the case that corporate America says, well, if the banks are going to be more constrained on lending to me and providing liquidity to me, I better self-insure as well and maybe over-insure lest I find myself in a financial crisis and, unlike the last one, not have, if Steve's right, not have the ability to get liquidity from the banks. And so if it seems to me it's worth studying that to find out whether we've hit the right balance. And again, not sure how you measure the benefits, but certainly you can measure the cost of saying that there must be some kind of an overhang on the economy if people are over-insuring.
Yeah, it's a tricky question in part because, yes, the regulations raise the cost of intermediation to not in the current situation where interest rates are at zero, but in most situations the Fed could offset that with lower interest rates to get the economy back to full employment, but there would be a different set of intermediation patterns. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it's a good point. We need to look at how we're forcing those intermediation patterns around and whether we're creating more risk and more dangers outside that system. Okay, Marcus and then Paul.
I find myself kind of bewildered here. I mean, first of all, to the point you said about Fed control of interest rates, I'm having a hard time seeing where the real economy cost comes from if it isn't mediated through interest rates, at least the bulk of it. And the Fed has had a lot of success in keeping interest rates down. I mean, up and down the bond markets, including for higher risk kind of debt, spreads are low, the absolute borrowing rates are low. And a lot of, and when you look under the hood of these cost-benefit analysis models, which I don't think, the Fed does a valiant job, but I think they're problematic because I don't think macroeconomics really understands the costs of financial intermediation. Or frankly, I don't think there's a macroeconomic theoretical proof that fractional reserve banking is like a necessary thing. But when you look under the hood, there's like in the DSGE model, you add on exogenously an extra charge onto the interest rate, from a higher capital ratio or more liquidity. And that's done kind of in this ad hoc way, and I'm kind of like, why can't the Fed make that go away? I am somewhat confused by how the theory of how these costs work. That's a confession of ignorance,
Let me take a stab at that. Mm-hmm. So there's this kind of ironic thing that we have, and I was a regulator for years, and regulators want market discipline, but a bank run is market discipline. We want to talk that we want it there, but when it happens, we hate it, and we want to stop it. Now, one of the discussions last panel was what's this maturity transformation value? And I thought there was a big literature in banking, and I'm thinking there's some guys in the audience that have written articles I read in graduate school about the banks issue short-term debt and invest in long-term because the short-term debt is the deposit, the ability to withdraw your deposits, a disciplining device. That you've got no vision on what the bank's investments really are, but the fact that you can come in and take your deposit out at any point in time, you know, scares the bejesus out of the bank owner, and controls his risk. It's a disciplining device. In corporate finance, you use short-term debt because it's cheaper, because the short-term debt holders have the option to get out sooner, right? Long-term debt costs more. So if we're telling the banks they have to fund themselves much longer term, there is a body of literature in finance, I think, and you can argue with me, that says the cost of financing a bank has got to go up. Now, they either got to make less profits and live with it and not charge higher loan rates, or they're going to pass the costs on. So I think there's a body of corporate finance and banking literature, at least the one that I read, and maybe I read it wrong. You know, my professors would tell me that, but I think it says that. I think we know that.
Can I add a number or two onto that?
Please.
Which is, because the cost on a macro basis, you're right, the Fed, under normal circumstances, when it doesn't have zero rates, could offset the macro costs. But it does change the relative prices of things. And in particular, and you can see this in the market today, large corporations fund today cheaper than they did pre-crisis. Small corporations fund 100 to 200 basis points more expensive than they did before the crisis because they're more dependent on banks. So what you've really done is you've shifted the cost of funding across different customers. The more they needed banks, the higher their funding has been. The less they needed banks, the lower their funding now is. So you've changed the structure of the U.S. economy with these banking rules toward large corporations, particularly multinationals and large issuers, and away from small and mid-sized businesses. You've had equivalent impact across consumers. The average credit card for someone who earns more than $250,000 today, right, is essentially exactly what it was 5 years ago. For someone who earns less than $100,000, it's about 300 basis points more. You've changed the relative prices of who needs a bank, and that has changed the economic outcome. Now, you may view a small business and a large business as, okay, that averages out, and that poor person and that rich person, that averages out. But to those people, it doesn't average out so well.
That is not AFR's position, by the way. Right. I mean, there are a couple things just in quick response to that. I'm with 1,000 researchers, I'm sure your data is more up to date.
I don't have 1,000. I was in the industry, but that's okay.
On the entire street. But, I think for at least a couple years post-crisis, some of those differentials in terms of the banks were frankly due to the capital overhang of undercapitalized banks prior to the crisis, that there was that attempt by banks, that need by banks to recapitalize themselves post-crisis, you know, did have an impact. And that's actually, I think you have to look at that as a cost of undercapitalization prior to the crisis more than a cost of rules post-crisis, because I think the market was demanding that and would have demanded that independently of the regulators. So I think there's something about the bank stresses that relates to lower capital ratios before the crisis that isn't often commented on. So that was one point I wanted to make.
I'd like to bring it back to the 13.
I'm sorry. Just one other quick thing.
Okay.
We actually do support regulation in the shadow banking system. What form that regulation takes is entirely another question. But I think having this only within the banking sector does raise some real problems.
Okay, great. Thanks, Marcus. Mm-hmm. So I'll bring it back to the provision of liquidity in crisis times, in troubled times. And I think we heard a couple of different views on 13.3. Paul Kay, certainly, and Randy felt that 13.3 might not be available enough to to sell your options or to provide the bankruptcy backup liquidity, whereas Marcus thought there was plenty of room in 13.3. So I'd like to hear your thinking through this as you heard some of these other views.
Okay. So I had some slides prepared on liquidity in the SPOE. And my view, I wasn't really, the way I read the SPOE and the FDIC's paper, strategy paper on SPOE, where they explain it is, they're not going to the Fed for liquidity. They think that their line of credit, the orderly liquidation fund privileges with the Treasury are big enough that they could provide a guarantee and the bridge company could fund itself in the market with a guarantee. Now, I would point out, I think there were some facts thrown around. According to the FDIC's paper, their access to the SPOE is 10% of the consolidated assets of the entire holding company when it's first taken over. It moves to 90% after they do a complete revaluation of all the assets, which takes 6, 7, 8 months. It takes a long time. It doesn't happen in a week. So really, you have 10%. You have a 10% line of credit with the Treasury before something special has to happen. And then the question is, when you go through an SPOE, and actually had an example where, sorry about that, but I actually went through Wells Fargo and had them fail, but I won't show you. So the problem is you've got to recapitalize probably the biggest bank, because the biggest bank is where the loss is going to be. So you have to recapitalize that. You have to recapitalize the holding company. And really, none of these things is going to come under FSOC, let's close this thing, unless there's a run first, right? These things never violate the capital requirement, and people look at the end of one quarter and say, oh, yeah, it's too low, let's go close it. They run, right? They run, and they've already gone to the Fed, and the Fed says, we're not lending anymore. You guys do something about this. And so the run has already happened. So if you've already run 10% of your deposits, if you have a WAMU run, 8.8% of your deposits in a short amount of time. So you need 8.8% of the assets just to refund the deposits, or it's an asset, a fire sale, which you're trying to prevent. And then you've got to plug the losses. And so my view is if you're going to rely on this Dodd-Frank Title II OLA fund, 10% is probably not enough realistically, because the equity isn't going to be the real equity in the book, and there's going to be, you're going to have to fund runs and losses. So I think even not going to the Fed.
Okay. Randy, do you have some comments?
It's interesting. I'm going to focus on 13.3, but let me just make one comment on the OLF, because it's interesting. A lot of the people that observe it actually think it gives the FDIC a lot more room than it appears at first glance. So the FDIC, I think, has actually said in various times that they think they can revalue the assets pretty quickly. And if they really needed to get to 90%, they could revalue very, very fast. Now, whether it would be an accurate revaluation or not, I'm not sure. They also believe that the Orderly Liquidation Fund actually gives them the ability to do guarantees, and that and that they get a much, it's only like maybe a 0.5% for every dollar of guarantee that would count against the 10%. So I think there are ways, I think most people are actually concerned that the OLF actually is unconstrained, and we've actually, I think the industry and others have suggested that it probably makes sense, and I think the FDIC has now said this as a matter of policy, that they will actually, instead of using it the way it could be used, at least under the Title II, they will in fact use it like a traditional lender of last resort and have it be fully secured at above market interest rates and so forth, which I actually think is a good idea, because I don't think you want to actually create a possible situation where there are actually losses that need to be spread around the industry, which I don't think is really a good idea. But on 13.3, I think the problem is if I were in a room and I were pressed and I were the general counsel of the Federal Reserve 20 years from now, when someone needs to take a creative interpretation of 13.3, I think I could probably get to find a way to use 13.3 in one of these situations. The problem is that, number one, the way to get there might be to make it, you have to basically make it available to the whole world. And so it seems to me that that's an odd way to say, we don't want you to make it available to one or two unless you make it available to the whole world. And so the Fed says, look, we really have to make it available to one or two, so I guess we'll make it available to the whole world. That doesn't strike me as fiscally very sensible. The second thing, though, is that it's the uncertainty, the market uncertainty about, when all the lawyers all around the country are being advised by the buy side saying, what's going to happen here? Will there be enough liquidity? Will this SPOE work? under either Title II or under the bankruptcy code, and there's going to be hundreds or thousands of people looking at the law, and they're going to say, we really don't know what it says. We really don't understand these constraints. We don't really know how constrained it will be, whether it will be invoked or not. And I think that's the problem. I think the uncertainty, it would actually be much better to know that it's a clear on or off in a situation as opposed to wondering whether it will be available or not.
I think you also have to take account what the part of the market you're going to be in, and this is part of the reason I want to separate out the short-term debt market. The short-term debt market doesn't deal with uncertainty well at all. Even after, and I'm sure, Don, you remember this, even after the government guaranteed everything, the short-term bond funds wanted legal opinions on every instrument for a while to make sure that was really true. Right? So I think the problem that has most of us concerned in executing an SPOE is how long will it take the buy side to get comfortable with what's actually happened and filling that gap, right? Because the short-term funding market just isn't very good at dealing with institutional uncertainty. I think people are very comfortable with the notion that you can super capitalize these entities, not just capitalize them, but super capitalize them. But whether, in fact, you can get the buy side to get that into their system or not, right, I think is substantially uncertain, and particularly on the non-bank side. And I think that's the gap, the bridge financing that has people concerned, is what do you do with that? And then you have the sort of unrelated stuff. You know, Charlie made that speech about nothing's ever been having to do except with solvency. Well, we all have recently lived through these types of runs in Europe, where as each country got into trouble and people had questions about depositive funds, governments had to step in and effectively guarantee stuff to stop the runs. Right? You get contamination risk all the time in these high-stress environments. And so it's also not clear that you won't need to supply liquidity in that context to all sorts of related firms in this, and related in the following sense, might have similar exposures.
Right.
Right? And we've seen that occur many times.
So I guess the question would be whether the Fed would be constrained against doing that through a broadly available
that's right.
facility or not.
I mean, my job in the 87 crash was to make sure that Sy-Keene called enough banks to make sure enough broker-dealers, futures merchants, and everything else could open the next day. Right. The concern was not about the banks.
But let me just say one thing. I mean, just one observation. I mean, one can create as many hypotheticals as you want, but what's the realistic probability that a G-SIFI will fail idiosyncratically, blow through $500 billion of treasuries with a problem that is unique to that institution so that the conditions associated with 13.3 won't be readily available? That's not going to happen.
I agree. You're going to have all of them
right.
at once.
Right.
And
so the reality,
but who's going to fund all of them at once?
Well, I mean, that's where the lender of last resort has to come in to stop a crisis of confidence, you know?
And I guess the question is whether the new restrictions on 13.3 will make the Federal Reserve more reluctant to pull that trigger than they were before.
This is something where it really helps to have the rules in front of you and the law in front of you, and I have neither memorized them nor do I have them right in front of me, though I did recently write a regulatory comment on the 13.3 rules. And my understanding and memory of it is there really is not a definition of broad-based. So you could restrict it, say, to primary dealers and more than one. I think if you were a creative lawyer, and the Fed has a lot of creative lawyers, you can fit even a very narrow market definition inside of that broad-based. The solvency requirement is simply that someone not currently be in bankruptcy. That's it for solvency. So you could meet someone on the courthouse steps with an offer to, finance their inventory of securities, and they'd be like, great, and there would be nothing wrong with that. That's actually in the statute, that definition of solvency. So I do think it's not an institutional funding mechanism, it's a market funding mechanism, but you can really identify most institutions, most big SIFIs, are big players in a couple of markets that are readily identifiable, and they'll be getting that support for their asset valuations, I think, from 13.3. And in terms of SPOE, that 1090 issue is very technical, and again, it'd be good to have the statute here, but I would point out
that... We do, he's to your right.
That's true, actually. I spent a lot of time on your website. The 10% is your last book value from your last audited financial statement, so your last quarterly report before you go down.
Right.
So you're talking, you know, $200 billion line of credit or something like that. It's your asset value. That's a lot of money.
But the sub debt at the parent of the top tier holding company is supposed to be about 10% of the assets too that converts. Mm-hmm. So right there, you've got the sub debt that you're going to convert into the new equity in the bridge equaling 10%. Mm-hmm. Now, I disagree with Randall. I don't believe they can revalue all the SIFI's assets that quickly, especially if it's complicated. But if people are willing to sign that they're all and they're audited and revalued and then get 90%, then that does solve the problem. But I worked in the FDIC for a long time, and it takes them a year.
Do they actually have to be audited? I'm not sure they have to be.
I think that there's a whole thing, and the Secretary of Treasury has to be happy that they've been revalued. I thought there were breaks in there to prevent getting too much OLA liquidity out of the liquidity, and if you would just get 90%, if after 3 days you say, oh, yeah, we think they're worth X, that doesn't seem like much of a check, but it might work that way.
One comment I would make, to the extent that actually is a genuine problem, the fact of the matter is if you actually do a single point of entry and you have a recapitalized bank, there's no reason it can't have access to the discount window. So you've got the discount window and the OLF, yeah. You know, basically but providing.
Not so much maybe for the non-bank affiliates.
Not for the non-bank affiliates.
That's the right. Issue. Can I, before we turn to the audience, I have one question. There's a change of subject slightly. There have been a number of comments, including from myself in the first panel, about the adverse political environment and David Wessel last night. So I'm going to start with Paul Saltzman. In addition to holding terrific conferences at Brookings to educate people who are probably think they know it all already. Anyhow, what can we do to change the, by we, I mean just the, everyone generally, to change the political discourse? How can this education process work? Do you have any thoughts about changing attitudes?
Humility, you know. I think the banking industry needs to show more humility, both with respect to its actions during the crisis and its relative standing in the economy. We go into meetings, we walk on the streets, and there's this presumption that people know or should know that we as an industry add value. I don't think as an industry we're sensitive enough to the pain. I've had occasion recently to travel to some cities across our country, Buffalo, Cleveland, others, where a lot of people hurting out there. So I think the banking industry needs to show some humility, number one. Number two, I think we need to recalibrate our approach to opposing rules and regulations and not always, as many people have said, the sky is falling every time a particular rule comes into play. Other than that, like anything, it's a Jeffersonian, Hamiltonian thing. Banks have been vilified for 2,000 years. They will continue to be vilified for the next 2,000 years. And I think it's our job to continue.
Or a Jacksonian thing. Maybe,
or a Jacksonian whatever. Thing, right? I think it's just a question that the industry needs to plow through the current situation, hope that some of these rules and regulations are calibrated appropriately, and if there is harm, that it's short-term harm that can be quickly changed. Perhaps I wasn't around, but you take the Eurobond markets, there were some tax issues. People thought that was temporary. Next thing you know, the whole market moves to London. We're a little cavalier about the long-term impact of some of these structural changes, particularly with respect to the shadow banking. But I think we just need to, as an industry, continue to present the value proposition. Most large banks are community banks. Many of the G-SIFIs have as much, if not more, presence in terms of lending and employment than a lot of the other community banks. It's very hard when some of these issues become religious to sort of pound through the perception, but we just have to keep on trying.
Right. Does anyone else have thoughts on this? Mandy.
It's interesting. I, I think the banking industry should do everything it can to try to support, and everybody should, a better economy. I think, frankly, if people were a lot happier with their job, you know, the level of employment, the jobs, the prospects of the future, they'd be less grumpy and looking for, you know, the banking industry to criticize. I think part of the problem is we continue to sort of bump along in an economy that's struggling, I think.
Interesting. Let's go to the audience. Do we have some questions out there? In addition to Bert.
Okay. Yes. It's like the Helen Thomas of the Brookings conferences.
Dale Ponick, Farm Bill Bank Tweed. Steve, you made a comment, which I'd like all to react to, that if you're going overboard with liquidity regulations, basically you're pushing the problem into the, quote, real economy instead. And you distinguished your experience with 2009 and 1987. Is that where we should be going? You didn't give a qualitative judgment of that, and do other people agree? Is that a good way to go?
I think it is an unnecessary way to go. I think that if there was more attention paid to the institutional microstructure reform and trying to simply get the collateral markets to work better, you could potentially not have to transfer it, but could actually manage it better. You know, part of the problem with the belt suspenders, more belts and suspenders, is that it allows people not to fix the underlying problem, which tends to be transparency. There was a comment made earlier today about how the dangers of mark-to-market. Well, part of the reason people didn't know whether banks were solvent or not is they didn't believe the balance sheets. And so correcting the information issues, correcting the market structure issues, and then relying on it is, I think, the way one manages to make markets work better, right? And when you make them self-insured, you inevitably make them work worse. And I think that's the sort of bad road we've gone down. It's very understandable. It's nevertheless probably not net good for the way the economy is going to operate.
Do any other panelists have a comment on that?
Yeah, so I have two comments. One on the short-term funding market issue that Steve has been raising, which I think is really important, and the other very directly responsive to that question on the real economy. I just find myself going back to the short-term funding issue because I just think it's so central. This was the core of the crisis in many ways. It is impacted and I think should be impacted by regulation. I mean, look, I have no doubt that the short-term lending markets generate money for the people who use them. That's why they use them. I also have no doubt that they're unstable and they're fragile, which is an implication of a lot of things that Steve has been saying. And is part of the problem. The fact that they generate money for people who use them is not a reason to say that they're generating social benefits necessarily. I mean, what the short-term funding markets do, in a way, they're a money creation market, right? They let you take things that are not money-like, that are illiquid long-term, and convert them into things that are money-like, except that money-like asset that you now have is very fragile because it's very liable to people deciding, hey, this isn't money-like, and looking through to what's beyond it. And when we do monetary policy, we don't say, oh, well, the Fed should create as much money as possible at all times because clearly that will give people more money, and more money is good. We look at a very, very complex kind of model of the relationship between the money supply and growth and what's a sustainable money supply. And we've kind of let money creation get away from us a little bit, and I think that's one of the deep underlying issues with the short-term funding markets. And then just in more direct response to this, I think in the period of the 50s through the 70s, we had an extremely strict set of regulations on banks in particular, much stricter than what's being considered now. And I think we did have more sort of credit crunches in the real economy earlier on in the economic cycle, that the economic swings weren't quite as violent. They were felt in inventory and in financing earlier, I think. But that seemed to lead to, in some ways, a milder, I mean, one can argue about this, but a milder business cycle than we've seen more recently. So I think it's kind of an interesting question. If you push some of those risks out earlier, do you kind of moderate the cycle a little bit? I don't have an answer to it, but I just point back to that historical period.
Yeah, but I would just, you know, this business about looking to 1780 and 1950, you know, for regulatory regimes or market structures, you know, the propagation vehicle. We live in a globalized economy, and so I'm not so sure you can, and a lot of people have done this often, you look at a market structure or a rule that occurred in a certain time and fast forward it. It's highly unlikely that in today's modern economy you can have a crisis that is as micro. So I guess maybe an answer to the question, and I don't know if Steve would agree, you know, isn't it appropriate trade-off to say, okay, we've solved for the systemic crisis in exchange for periodic pockets of crises in markets that can be managed? I think that's a pretty good trade-off.
All right. Yes.
Michael Pomerlano, I was very intrigued by your proposal to auction, this option that, frankly, it appeals to me because it's a solution, actually. Does create certain open market discipline and so on. Could I hear maybe from the others, particularly Don, what he thinks about the feasibility of this proposal?
So we did it for Y2K.
Yeah.
We sold, the New York Fed sold options to get liquidity from the New York, sold options ahead of time to get liquidity on January 2nd or whatever the first working day of 2000 was. So it's been done, but been done for commercial banks. And I think to do it more broadly for non-banks and have it traded in markets raises a whole host of questions. Not only would you need to change the law, but you need to think about the moral hazard you were setting up and what the access was, et cetera. So it's not...
It's not meant to take credit risk. It's meant to take away repo, haircut, jump risk, like happened in 2007, 2008.
Right.
Defining which assets are liquid.
Right.
Yeah.
But he wasn't restricting who had access to these options because they're traded on...
In my best world, I would want the shadow banks to have access. Maybe that's not possible today.
Creates issues of moral hazard, I think.
So
there are problems to be solved, but an interesting thing. Does anyone else on the panel?
I think it's an interesting idea. I mean, I think Don's point about having the alienability of these options extend beyond the banks raises questions, but you could... start and have this be a tradable derivative within the banking system. So I think it's an idea worth pursuing.
I think it's quite possible that anything along those lines could help the system. If you go back to 1987, which I know I've brought up a couple times, Alan Greenspan simply saying the window was open proved to be enough that the window was never used. Right? So in some sense, if people knew there was a baseline of liquidity out there, it might actually solve the problem of liquidity.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Martin.
This session had the word world in it, and so I'm going to ask if you can broaden your discussion a little bit to say we have New York has been a global center. When the crisis hit, world trade kind of collapsed for a period because people couldn't get financing that was coming out of New York. So there was a kind of liquidity crisis that happened with respect to global trade. So my question really is, if we think about this in a global context, does it ease the U.S. liquidity problem because we have access to global markets, or does it make it a more difficult problem because we're providing global liquidity?
I'll just leave a quick comment. I think it's infinitely more complicated. The dollar is the world's reserve currency. So, the total supply, I would suspect that foreign banking organizations are going to satisfy their own HQA requirements by acquiring treasuries. There isn't enough total sovereign outside of the U.S. to satisfy the global liquidity requirements. So I would think when one looks at it at a global level, but one has to look at this at a global level in order to sort of assess the impact on the U.S. economy. I think that's pretty self-evident.
Marcus, you look like you had something to say. No?
Oh.
Okay. He always looks like he has something.
The wheels are always turning. I think the role of the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency and the Fed as a financial capital, I think, is a very good. There are lots of justifications, but a very good justification for the reasons why the Fed has gone super equivalent on so many of these rules. And I think it's also a very important justification for the foreign banking organization rule that we're really kind of the backstop in a lot of ways. So we have to make sure that we're extra secure, and that gives us also benefits in terms of the flight to safety that occurs into U.S. financial institutions in times of stress.
Any other questions? Charlie.
Thanks. Charlie Thomas from the Federal Reserve Board. So getting back to Paul's option, one obvious part of it is that as they get resold off, they can be sold to anyone, presumably. But doesn't that then leave the Fed with a repo against anybody, right? And so the idea that the counterparty is somehow still on the hook beyond what the repo is worth is gone, right? I mean, now, let me finish. But so you would sort of say, well, okay, fine, I'm only lending against that collateral, and I don't care who the counterparty is. But that's a really odd position to be in when in the same paragraph you're saying that the lender of last resort only lends to, goddammit, solvent institutions against good collateral.
I'm taking that apart. The whole idea that you have to control haircuts in the shed, the aim of my idea is to lessen the blow of the LCR and the bank regulations, to give you more collateral that satisfies those, so it's not as constraining, but also to inject liquidity into the shadow banking market where repo and collateral was a big deal in the crisis, and to put some underlying. So if the Fed were only to issue out of the money options, okay, and maybe there, and I think I might have slipped in or it might have not said it, but there could be some, if it went to outside the banking system, which I would prefer, there could be some membership requirements, like if at the end of your collateral you don't deliver, we're going to send you over to the FSOC and the SPOE, and you're just out of business, right? You don't muck with your regulator and deliver. You have basically a month to get your short-term funding in order if you have one of these repos. So, and if the Fed were to exercise one of these repos and it were in isolation, that would mean the true haircut was smaller than the haircut that this firm was getting, and the Fed wouldn't really have a risk. It'd be able to probably turn around and sell the bond if it wanted to. But if everybody were exercising these repos, you'd be in a situation where there was some systemic liquidity problem, and the Fed would have a month to see the prices and figure out what they want to do. Do they want to issue more liquidity insurance? How do they want to handle it? Send the boys in to see what's going on, and the girls, sorry, in to see what's going on in that collateral, what is happening in that market. So I don't think it fixes everything, but I think it gives you some market signals, and it puts a bit of a safety net under the non-lender of last resort. It expands the Fed's ability to be lender of last resort, but not against the firm, against collateral with a significant haircut. And if the haircut's big enough, there's no credit risk. If the world falls apart in a month, we all have a problem, and they're going to have to provide liquidity anyway, right? So that's kind of my thinking. But I don't have a full-fledged dynamic general equilibrium model or any of this stuff yet. It was just kind of trying to think through how can we get a market into this process so that we can get some information back and make some money off of selling the fact that the Fed is going to have to sell systemic liquidity insurance, and they should charge for it.
Steve's got the last word.
I mean, we've looked at some related problems, and actually, I think you've actually stated the answer, and the question raises the correct one, which is if you want to make it transferable, you're going to have to link it to a related clearinghouse, right? Because the key issue in collateral is it there, and is it valued correctly, right? And so if you deal with the microstructure issue, which you need to do it to make it transferable, right, you end up with something akin to a collateral clearinghouse, right? Because that's the only way you can make it transferable, right? And that then in turn creates all the other rules you're talking about. I think from that standpoint, that becomes the institutional link that would you'd have to think about.
Can you limit? Can you limit your option product to CCPs, and maybe that's the way you introduce the liquidity pricing mechanism into the system?
Right, we can continue that. We can work out the tiny technical details over Coke, or Pepsi, or whatever it is out there, and cookies. So join me in thanking the panel.